The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Invaders. Alien beings from a dying planet. Their destination, the Earth. Their purpose, to make it their world. David Vincent has seen them. For him, it began one lost night on a lonely country road looking for a shortcut that he never found. It began with a closed, deserted diner and a man too long without sleep to continue his journey. It began with the landing of a craft from another galaxy. Now, David Vincent knows that the invaders are here, that they have taken human form. Somehow he must convince a disbelieving world that the nightmare has already begun.
Join us now as we get lost in space.
I'm Al Warren, and tonight we're lost in space with author-researcher Greg Lawson. Now, he's going to talk to us about the truth of Roswell. He's done a lot of research. Very interesting. Right after these words.
This is Edward James Olmos. Did you know that today, one out of every four American kids is Hispanic? That means many of the future doctors, engineers, and entrepreneurs of our country can be your kids. We all know how hard it is for you to send them to college. This is why many support you. And the Hispanic Scholarship Fund helps you prepare, plan, and pay for your kids' college education. Learn more at hsf.net. Brought to you by the Hispanic Scholarship Fund and the Ad Council.
I'm really psyched Subway's bringing the flavor with this new guacamole for a couple of reasons. First, people really love our guacamole. Rich and creamy, made from Haas avocados and just a hint of jalapeno to keep it interesting. The other reason is, it's just really fun to say. Guacamole.
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 Guacamole. See?
Come in and try our new guacamole on sandwiches like the Chipotle Chicken Melt and discover how it turns up the flavor on all your favorite sandwiches.
Subway. Eat fresh.
It's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
Now joining us, Greg Lawson. Thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us tonight.
You're welcome. I enjoy it.
Oh, good. Now, from my little bit of research and that, you're quite the research specialist, and you've done a lot on Roswell. And so I thought, you know, maybe to start things out, maybe you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we can get into the events of 1947. So who is Greg Lawson?
Yeah, who is? That's a good question. I'm a 51-year-old man. I spent 10 years in the military. I have a condition called AFADD. It's called Armed Forces Attention Deficit Disorder. I did 4 years Army, 4 years Navy, and 2 years Air Force. I never made it over to the Marine Corps. I was kind of done after the 10th year there. But in the Army, I was an infantry parachutist. In the Navy, I was an operations specialist on Nimitz. And in the Air Force, I was a security forces person. And in between those stints in the military, I've spent a little over 23 years as a law enforcement officer in Central Texas, as a deputy sheriff, a patrol officer, SWAT guy, underwater recovery team guy, and detective for child abuse, sex crimes, and so homicide detective. And I became interested in the paranormal realm, I guess, when my wife, best friend, moved to Roswell, and we started going up there visiting her about 12, 13 years ago. And since then, I've kind of branched from Roswell into some of the other paranormal realms, mainly specializing in processes of investigation. So I don't necessarily go off into the dark with my equipment and try to hunt ghosts or anything like that, but I do help people who do that with their processes and their evaluations of the evidence that they bring back. So that's what I do.
Wow. Well, that sounds pretty interesting. Now, so you've always been involved in sort of the, I want to say helping people in the way, being in the military and then into the police and homicide and stuff. Was there something that drove you there? Like, were you from a military family or a policing family, or was it just something that you had an urge to do?
Yeah, I think it was just an urge. I remember when I was a kid, I couldn't very well stay still. I was always pretty busy. And I was an average student. And in sixth grade, we had to go pick out a book. And we had to read the book and do a book report. And I had never read an entire book. And I went and picked several books. And all of the books were something like The Search for Atlantis, or, you know, the Mayan Inca ruins, or, you know, whatever. And so I've always been interested in mysteries, I guess. As far as my military service, I wanted to jump out of airplanes and go to other countries and see the world and have somebody pay for it. So that worked out well. I got a little over 50 countries between the three branches. So I got to travel quite a bit and had a really good time doing it. So people say, thank you for your service. I say, thank you for paying for it, you know, because I got to do some good traveling.
Yeah. Well, no, but that's great. It's good. It's good to hear. I see and hear so much in the media, because I'm part of it, about the ups and downs and bads and goods about policing and stuff like that. And I try not to jump on the thank you for your service, but I certainly do the old, I really appreciate police and military, and that they change their lives and do this to keep our country the way it is, you know. You know, I certainly really appreciate it. And, I have a lot of respect for people that put their whole lives to it, because you've really you're 51 now, so you've dedicated really your life for this kind of service.
Pretty much my whole adult life, except for about 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's a lot of great people in the military. There's a lot of great people in law enforcement. And we have some bad people, too.
Yeah.
Just like we have some bad priests and some bad dentists and some bad, veterinarians. We have that percentage of the people that fall through the cracks. And then we make, you know, they do something. You know, if a cop lies, all cops lie.
Right.
That's the way people kind of perceive it. So,
yeah.
But you know, especially for cops understand this. It's like the sheepdog. The sheep's, they don't like it. The sheep don't like us. I just said sheep. The sheep don't necessarily care for us. Right. And the wolves don't care for us.
Yeah.
And we understand that. And that's just the way it is. And we know that what our purpose is. And we're going to get, blackballed sometime. We're going to get treated bad sometime. But we understand that's part of the job, and you if you get knocked down, you get back up, dust off, and try to go make the best decision you can.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, that's the positive way you can look at it. And I just wished as a society we had grown up a little bit more than that and would realize that, there's good and there's bad in every industry. Just because we have a bad dentist, they're not all bad. Same as cops or anything. I'm just more into the support of people and doing what they can right and doing it well. So, you know,
right.
That's all. But enough about that. But anyway, thank you for all the work you've done. So now you get into... So you start visiting Roswell, and was there something in particular about Roswell that made you kind of go, I'd like to know more about this?
Absolutely. You know, Stanton Freeman kind of posed the question in 1978. He did an interview with Jesse Marcel, who was the individual that was actually sent out in the field to do whatever the identification or the recovery of some material that was found on a ranch out there. And so, I was kind of interested in that. And so I started looking into it more and more and read a couple of books on it and thought, wow, this is about one of the biggest cover-ups I've seen. And the thing about it is, you got to remember, I mean, this happened in 1947.
Right.
So Stanton Freeman poses the question in 1978. Well, that's 31 years later. That is a cold case.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at something like Roswell, well, Roswell was Roswell Army Airfield. So it was right in the middle, a little bit past the middle, of the transition of the Army Air Corps turning into the United States Air Force. So I don't know if you've ever been through any kind of a transition within a large organization, but it's typically pretty much chaos and nobody really knows what anybody else is doing. And people are struggling over power and authority and they're trying to figure out how this new United States Air Force is going to operate. So, they have what would be considered by the citizens around there a major incident. And how are they going to handle that? So, and there's a lot of things that led up to the actual report of the downed craft. But, it was very confusing, I'm sure, for them at the time. And this is just as confusing, or not, if not more, in 1978, 31 years later.
Right, right. That's when it started to have growing interest then. What were the parts that led up to it? Actually, was there that you're talking
about? I mean, there's always been lights in the sky. You know, the whole ancient alien theory and anything you look back in history, you know, the human beings are looking to the skies for answers, and so there's a lot of people out there at night watching what's going on, and there's little reports of what people would consider a spacecraft or some sort of aircraft doing certain things. And certainly in World War II, a lot of pilots reported seeing different things. And I'm sure you've talked about and know about Foo Fighters.
Oh, yeah.
That a lot of the pilots would see, and basically a lot of them would talk about, you know, these glowing orbs that would come up and fly around their aircraft and then speed off. And so that was in the back of people's minds when all this is going on. And depending on what version of Mac Brazel's statements you follow, because there's a couple of different ones and they're contrary to one another, is when it all started about. But in June of June 25th, about 1947, a pilot named Kenneth Arnold was up there in the Washington area, and he was flying south, and he reported some flying discs that he saw, and he estimated their speed, you know, over 1,000 miles an hour, and there were several of them. So this hit the newspapers, and you know, he's shown in a couple of different interviews. He's got a picture of some of the drawings of what he thought he saw, and so that was about June 25th. Well, Mac Brazel, for those who don't know, he was a rancher out in New Mexico, and in one of his versions, June 14th in 1947, get that date based on, he said, about 3 weeks ago on July 8th. So there's a couple of different statements where there's some, like I said, there's some date disparities there. But, I mean, think about it. It's 1947. I'm sure he didn't have, being a rancher, and riding a horse, I'm sure he didn't have a calendar in his back pocket.
Right.
So I'm not sure how he kept track of dates. But anyway, he says that he's out checking on some fences. He's out riding some part of the property, and he finds a very large debris field. And this debris field, you know, causes concern to him. And shiny material, lots of different pieces, and anywhere, depending on what version you hear, 100 yards long to 300 yards long and as wide. So that's a pretty large debris field. And if you go with the first statements of, you know, it was around June 14th or so, it's amazing that he didn't come forward sooner if he had a spacecraft crashed on his ranch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
If that was the case, I would think that he would come forward sooner. But he actually waits till July 7th. He, like I said, just depending on who you read, I'm getting most of this out of actually the Roswell newspaper. As far as the timelines go, because they didn't keep a lot of records of what happened back then. And so you can always fall back on the newspaper if it was newsworthy. So on July 4th, he says that he returns to that area and gathers up the debris. Some accounts say it was his family with him, and depends on, like I said, who you're listening to. But bottom line, he's out there. He finds this debris, he collects it up, and when he goes into town on July 7th, he goes straight to the sheriff. And there's a guy named George Wilcox. And George, you know, decides, well, this is probably military. We need to turn this information over to the Roswell Army Airfield. So that's what they end up doing. And that's where, in July 8th, 1947, the Roswell Daily Record throws the headlines of RAAF, the Roswell Army Airfield, captures flying saucer in Roswell region. Now, it's interesting, if you look back, the Kenneth Arnold report out of Washington State from June 25th of that same year, just a few days earlier, he reported flying discs. And the actual newspapers changed the wording to flying saucers. And so that's the first place that we actually see them using the word flying saucers. So that's interesting on how, you know, the evolution of a story flows, and certain things get said later that weren't said in what I call an alpha report. What is the first person who has seen or reported something? That's the report that we need to go to. That's really, really important to follow. So from June 14th, the debris, to July 7th, he talks to George Wilcox, to July 8th, the Roswell Daily Record puts out the, they found a flying saucer. Interesting thing is the very next day, Roswell Army Airfield does a retraction. General Ramey says, no, that's not it. It's a balloon, and the story gets buried. That was July 9th, 1947. You don't see anything, much of anything after that until 1978 with Stan Freeman. Reviews this information through the newspaper, and then contacts Jesse Marcel and does that interview. So,
I would think, but I don't know. I mean, you're the detective here, but one thing is, yeah, you were saying that. Why would he have this landed or crashed aircraft of some sort, flying saucer, and not do anything about it for a while?
Well, and he actually changes his story after that, and he says when they re-interview him, they put out another smaller story. It says Rancher regrets reporting the aircraft. And he then says that it was on July 4th that he found it and he collected it up. And, you know, he's so far out there in the country that, you know, he had some things to take care of and he brought it in on July 7th. But, you know, depending on whose version of the Roswell incident you really put credence in, Randall and Schmidt did a book, UFO Crash at Roswell, and Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, Kevin Randall, really did the meat and potatoes of this stuff. I mean, you know, Stanton Freeman came forward and got this thing going, but Randall, Schmidt and Carey really stuck to it and kept interviewing people. And so, you know, the UFO crash at Roswell, the truth about the crash at Roswell, those are some of my, some of the best books that I've read as far as, the in-depth research. I would have never interviewed 300 people on anything. Yeah. I wouldn't have done it. In the kind of cases that I work, one of the number one things that we have to fall back on is case management. Right. And case management, you have to look at everything and say what's important and what's not. Now, the things that aren't important doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to get to them. We're just not going to do them first. So out of the 300 people that you would interview, I'm pretty sure you could probably put the case to bed with, 10 or less good witnesses. You might need another 20 to support some of the things that they said, but 30 witnesses, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So, you know, Randall and Schmidt and Carey, I mean, they interviewed hundreds of people about this. And that's where the, you know, some of the debunkers and Roswell haters, called the Roswellian syndrome, is everybody wanted to jump on the bandwagon and, oh, they're writing a book. Yeah, I saw something, you know, and they come running up and want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
So.
And that's great. But when you get back to the, so when you, Why did he change his story? When someone changes their story initially, it's usually because you're trying to hide something, or you're, you know, or trying to get something, or you're trying to please someone, right? Like you're aiming your story to make them like what you're saying, or did you ever figure kind of what the option of why he would have originally, why he changed his story, period? Like
at this point, you know, so many years after, it would be pure speculation on my part.
Of course, yeah.
There are some theories behind it. I tend to go with the first story told.
Okay.
So if his first story says, about 3 weeks prior to July 8th, you know, so it's July 8th and he's speaking. He says, yeah, about 3 weeks ago, I saw this material.
Right.
Had some stuff to do. I had to take care of this. And then I went back over there and I collected it up day before yesterday. And I thought I'd bring some of it into town and show you. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. So I tend to stick with the Alpha Report. I stick with the first thing that comes forward and try to work from there. And as you're asking, you know, why would he change his story later? Well, the researchers, the guys that are really the real Roswell researchers, they dug off into this, and they believe that the Roswell Army Airfield, the Counterintelligence Corps, the intel people at Roswell, and you know, the Roswell chain of command pressured him into changing his story so that they could hide the timeline. And depending on what the timeline was, whether they're actually trying to hide a UFO that crashed out there, or whether they were trying to hide the fact that a secret project crashed out there, because no matter what anybody thinks of this situation, that happened.
Yeah.
Something crashed out there. That's not anything that's in doubt. What's in doubt is, was it an extraterrestrial craft that traveled through time and space, thousands of light years in order to get struck by lightning over New Mexico and crash in the desert? That seems a little, if you can make it that far without, damaging yourself and you're going to get struck by lightning on Earth, that's not a good story.
No.
And there's hypothesis about, there was a lightning storm and the spacecraft got struck by lightning and it crashed. Well, that's, man, they need, they need some serious work on their airframes, because, we have aircraft all the time that get struck by lightning.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not all the time, but, it doesn't down the aircraft right there.
Thanks. I'm flying tomorrow. So.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. How's the weather?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have a lot of lightning out there. That's good.
Yeah, well, that's good.
But, yeah, so when you're looking at that, and that's completely plausible. You know, you're a rancher. You're herding animals all day long. You just want to make a living. You want to go to church. You want to go have dinner. You want to have family.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these military people saying, hey, this is at the end of World War II, so everybody's thinking a little bit differently. You know, there's a lot of patriotism, a lot of nationalism at that point.
Right.
So everybody wants to do their part for the war effort. So, you know, you got a guy like a colonel from the Air Force, or a general from the Air Force, or officers from the Air Force telling you, look, this is really important to national security. I need you to say this. I need you to say that you found it yesterday. We went out there. We got it. It's just a weather balloon. Everything's fine. Let's move forward. And rightfully so, a good farmer would do that. He'd go, yep, I'm going to do that for my country because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So if you have people that are pressuring them to change their stories, and
how did the name get changed to Saucer then? Flying Saucer, like what was that from?
Well, there were reported as flying discs originally from, like I said, Kevin Arnold, and just through the media, they just changed the noun from disc to saucer. because it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah,
the
same thing. Which is kind of...
But it was a newspaper reporter that did that. Nobody that saw a flying saucer report a flying saucer. Kevin Arnold reported flying discs.
Right.
And then the newspaper reporter turned around. And I don't know whether, I can't remember how they were sharing, the articles between, I don't know if it's teletype back then or how they were doing it. But anyway, so they got it and they just stuck a new title on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
I like flying saucer.
Well, I mean, I just hope that he got some sort of credit and royalties.
They should have. Yeah, they should have looked it up. I should look that up and figure out who did that.
Because he was
the first one that coined it.
The amount of time it's been used by now, God, they.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
You know, but that was a big deal when it happened. They make it seem that way on the TV and news reports that. You know, all the cops and the whole town all came out for the crash.
That's all just fake, right?
You see, that never happened. They've just done that for a movie.
Right.
Right.
There was only a handful of people that were directly involved in it. You know, you got Mac Brazel, the rancher.
Right.
You got Floyd and Loretta Proctor. They were the owner of the Proctor Ranch. They're the ones that told Mac he should go report it. You got George Wilcox, who's the sheriff of Chavez County. And Wilcox, when they end up reporting to Roswell Army Airfield, I don't know the actual chain, but Jesse Marcel, this information landed in Major Jesse Marcel's lap, and he was the intelligence officer for the Roswell Army Airfield. And you don't tell a major that's a head of intelligence for your airfield, hey, go out in the field and figure out what this is, unless you think it's something special. You know, if it's a weather balloon, they're going to send an enlisted person or a non-commissioned officer out there to collect up the stuff. They're not going to send the intel officer out there. And they're certainly not going to send the intelligence officer out there with two guys from the counterintelligence corps. And for those people who don't know what the counterintelligence corps is, they're the military people that lie to everybody to throw you off track. They're the counterintelligence. You got intelligence, you're trying to gather information. Counterintelligence, guess what you're doing? You're disseminating bad information. So, when you have the intelligence officer, then you got Captain Sheridan Cabot and a sergeant with him, a Sergeant Rickett, who was the NCOIC. He's a non-commissioned officer in charge of the counterintelligence corps. They all jump, depending on what version you listen to, they jump in cars and they head out there and Mac Brazel goes to show them the site. Some accounts of it is the counterintelligence guys actually drove trucks out there, or at least a truck out there to collect that debris. Like I said, there's no reports on any of this. They didn't, you know, people say, well, we got to find, you know, the reports of what happened. Well, back then, you got to remember, we're switching from the Army to the Air Force. They were used to aircraft crashing. You got a bulldozer out there, pushed it out of the way, got brooms, swept it off, and kept landing aircraft. It was wartime. They didn't have big manuals to go, okay, you know, what is the skid ratio and the coefficient of friction when this aircraft hit the ground the way they do now to determine how airframes, you know, respond to impact and what the G rates are. They didn't have that stuff.
Yeah.
So they weren't, you know, if they were working off anything, they were working out of a Big Chief tablet and a Crayola or something, you know, just writing down possibly what, you know, radio frequency they're operating off of and you know, what their latitude and longitude was. So it's really suspicious that they would send this group of people out in order to collect that information or collect the debris also. And that's something that you can fall back and go, well, you know, maybe maybe something else happened. Maybe Stanton Freeman's idea of that wasn't actually the crash site. Maybe the spaceship was traveling so fast that this is just an area where it hit the ground and skipped off the ground, just like a pebble on a stream, right?
Right.
You throw in pebbles on a stream, they can kind of skip across there. Well, that area out there isn't as flat as glass, but if an aircraft came in at a really super high rate of speed, something that probably faster than anything that we can even imagine, and it would hit there, that would tend to make you believe maybe it would strip some of the outer skin of the structure off, leave that behind, and the actual, you know, craft crashed in a different location. So it'd be a great plan to go, all right, let's send our intel guys out there and our counterintelligence guys out there. Have them take a look at that debris field and do that. And that's going to be the official response that we have for this incident. And in secret, let's get a bunch of trucks out and go to another location close to Corona and actually recover the spacecraft and do that. So there's that theory that that's what happened. And Stanton Freeman and some others prescribed to that theory. And at least the crash of Corona idea.
Right.
So it leaves a lot of questions.
So now, after it happened and then the years went by, what brought the huge interest all of a sudden in the late 70s to finding out this? Like, I understand, like, Stanton Friedman. Like, but what was there some sort of thing that all of a sudden made it catch on? Like, why would it just start?
Well, I think when you have an intelligence officer that admits that he lied in official records when he was, you know, there, and that would be Jesse Marcel saying, yeah, I lied about that. I was told to lie about that, and that's not what happened. This is what happened. So, you know, that perks a lot of people's interest because it was, you know, it was essentially a, not a debunked, but it was you know, buried. And you look at a lot of these different types of stories when they, you know, the story comes out, the crash at Roswell, and then they bury it the next day. No, there wasn't a crash. It was just a weather balloon.
Right.
And then it's buried, and it stays buried, and then people start talking a little bit about it. Hey, remember back then? It's a crash at Roswell. And then you have MUFON people, and you have some other people that are really watching what's going on as far as how the government is responding to UFO sightings. And we had tons of sightings. I know when I was a kid, 1970, I remember seeing these glowing objects. They look like stars way up in the sky, and they were moving across the sky. Well, I live near Bergstrom Air Force Base in Austin, and Bergstrom was the SAC base command. And, of course, they were launching weather balloons all the time. But it was something, you know, late in the afternoon, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, when you get those long, you know, sun rays coming across, and those balloons would glow pretty well. And it was always neat watching those things. So it turns into a mystery. It turns into a myth. And more people start talking about it. And if an intelligence officer comes forward and says that he lied and that they covered this up, that's a big deal. It damages the credibility of our government. Just like, you know, like I said before, when a cop lies, all cops are liars. Well, somebody does something wrong in the government, now all of the government is evil. All the government is bad. Some of the biggest things that really came out of that was that was actually about 10 years after Jesse Marcel's interview with Stanton Freeman. Glenn Dennis, there was a show, Unsolved Mysteries, mm-hmm. and they put out a show about UFOs, about Roswell, and Glenn Dennis calls Unsolved Mysteries and says, you know, I've saw aliens and I did this and I did that. Actually, he didn't see, he actually saw them, but he was working at a mortuary. He said he was working at a mortuary at a time, and he was, and he said that he received a call from the Roswell Army Airfield asking for caskets. Needed some child-sized caskets, and they were asking him some pretty unusual questions about that. That was in 1989. Glenn Dennis said that happened back in 47. Interesting enough, within 5 years, Glenn Dennis opened the museum in Roswell for the UFO museum. So that kind of damages his credibility a little bit when that happens, when he waits that long. So there's a lot of different investigations that went into, you know, researching Glenn Dennis's credibility. And, so he was at the Ballard Funeral Home for sure. A lot of the stuff that he talked about was actually impeached by Schmidt and Kerry and others. He changed some of his story. He had said that he was friends with a nurse at the Roswell Army Airfield Hospital, and that she had said that she experienced involvement with the aliens that they brought in from the crash, and he changed her name twice, so that you know when you start covering up your trail that can corroborate your evidence or your testimony, that's a big red flag.
Right.
And then, you know, if you call into a hotline while you're watching, Unsolved Mysteries in 1989, and then in 1991, you're one of the founders of the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, that causes some problems and makes people wonder what's going on, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's like a... That's really a good promotional tool, you know. So now of the books, you know, when the original, when they had like, taking all these witness accounts, having like 300 of them. Did they have problems really getting 300 good witness accounts? I mean, isn't that really tough to do?
Absolutely, and I want to say, you know, Don Schmidt is probably, I bet he's done over 500. He's a machine. Him and Tom Carey are just machines. That's, if they're not, taking care of family or doing something directly to make money, they're doing Roswell research. Those guys are machines, and they've done a great job. You know, like I said, if you go around and if I walk up to some people and I say, hey, I'm a well-known writer and I'm doing a research on this particular incident, and you describe the incident, and I'm looking for people that I can interview that I'm going to put in my book, do you know anything about it? And there's a lot of people that will just step right into that role. Oh, yeah, I sure do. My grandfather was there. He told me all about it. You know, he had this piece of material that he was afraid that the government was going to come get, so he buried it in the back part of our property, and I've never been able to find it, or stories along those lines.
Right.
So that's where that thing is where, you know, you can watch TV shows and cop shows, and you can kind of see what you think a cop does and how he behaves and the way he interviews people. Or, you know, you can go to some of the very in-depth interview schools. And some of the most basic interview schools, of course, are going to be in your basic law enforcement course. And depending on what state you're in, it's going to be whether it's 4 hours or 24 hours. Total time that you're going to spend studying on how to do who, what, when, where, and, you know, why, possibly. And And then, you know, there's other schools outside. The Department of Justice does a lot of interview schools. And then you have private companies like the Reed Technique. And you can, you know, Reed has your basic interview, your intermediate interview, your advanced interview, your, you know, I mean, they have all kinds of schools, and most of those schools are about 40 hours apiece. So there are a lot of things that you have to look for. And I'm not saying you have to interrogate somebody who is an experiencer of a paranormal event. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is it's really good to have that background. So when you're talking to somebody and they start throwing up signs of deception, that you're able to pick that up. Now, when they're doing that, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're lying about the incident. They could be lying about something surrounding the incident that they don't want someone else to know. So I hear cops all the time, I knew he was lying. I could tell a liar from a mile away. No, you can't. Mm. And you can't do it with a polygraph machine either. Polygraph machine is a tool for interviewing. Just because you're getting indications on a polygraph that the individual is lying about a question, as I said before, it doesn't mean that he's lying about that specific question. He could be lying to cover up his knowledge because he doesn't want his wife to know he was at that location at the time.
Right.
So he could be lying about something other than what you're trying to, the information that you're trying to get from him. And it makes him look like he's being deceptive on the question that you're answering, which is not necessarily true. So deception, dishonesty, they could be tricking you just for fun. Think about the, you know, people that are just hoaxing just for fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're trying to perform some sort of fraud, you know, cheating you out of something. Or, like you said before, what is their motivation? You know, maybe they're getting something out of this. Recognition by being in a book, or credibility for opening a business, or whatever. So,
yeah. When I said, well, just in the reading, it was over 300 plus individuals, but only 41 of them were considered genuine first or second hand witnesses.
Right.
So, I mean, even then, and you as a officer, I mean, how many times have you heard different stories from witnesses that were just really not true for whatever reason?
Once a week, at least.
So, and that's not even picking out saying that they were just bad people or liars or whatever. It just happens. People make mistakes. And when sometimes they're emotionally excited or whatever the reason, they don't always report accurate events?
Absolutely. You know, and people are prone to exaggeration, overstatement, embellishment, amplification, all kinds of different, enhancements of their story. And we are a creative people. Mm-hmm. We're a creative creature. And our brains try to make sense of the things that we see. That's a mystery. We try to fill things in automatically. Things that we see, you know, you can just play that. You can go online and just, play those visual games all day long. And our brain will fill in straight lines and circles and all kinds of other things that are not there. But because it recognizes a pattern in one part, it'll automatically fill that pattern in. And then you have, you know, all kinds of subconscious thought. You have a lot of things in your midbrain, in your amygdalas, that are triggering facial recognition, and your brain is constantly trying to put things together. And so the interesting thing about your brain is much better at forgetting things than it is memorizing things.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're retelling a story, you're building that story as you go along, and you're filling in a lot of the gaps that you might not have really paid attention to. It's interesting also, the interviewer, it's how you ask the question a lot of times is how embellished or how amplified the statement is. And I'll give you an example of I can take somebody who has witnessed a collision between two cars. And I can say, about how fast were the cars going? Or I can say, about what speed were the cars going when they touched each other? And they'll say, 30 miles an hour. And then if I said, how fast were the cars going when they ran into each other? Maybe 32, 35 miles an hour. How fast were they going when they smashed into each other? About 40, 45 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. How fast were they going when they careened into each other and came apart? Probably 70. You know?
Yeah.
It depends on how. And there's a lot of people out there that go, oh, that's not true. Well, it is. Just need to do some reading on some peer-reviewed studies on interview techniques.
Oh, yeah.
And it absolutely matters. So everything that the interviewer says will influence what the interviewee tells you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It has a huge influence. So do you consider any of the evidence lead to really some proof of such a crash?
As I said, there was a crash out there.
There was a crash. the weather balloon thing, it really kind of hurt it when the government came out a while back there. Remember, and they said it was a weather balloon and they wanted to, it doesn't help the image, right?
It makes it look like
they're lying. And,
sure, and they were lying.
Yeah.
And they've continued to be deceptive. But it was not a weather balloon. We know that, and the government has said it was not a weather balloon. The government's final story is it was a Mogul balloon, which was part of a reconnaissance kind of a surveillance program that we were running at the time, because we wanted to listen to the Russians and figure out whether the Russians are exploding nuclear weapons or not. So over at Alamogordo, they had a lot of graduate students. They still have graduate students and PhD students and stuff going through there. And they do their experiments and they do whatever it is that they're working on. And New York University had a balloon project going on over there. And so there was all these graduate students that were putting together these balloon trains and putting this equipment on these trains and putting radar reflectors on them and launching them into as high as they could possibly go. And they had ways to control a constant level. And so they were experimenting with a lot of that. And so that would be the most plausible explanation for this is, General Ramey, he's in charge of keeping stuff quiet. And, it would make sense that if they were running a top secret, constant level flight balloon program, and these kids from New York University were part of that, it would make sense to make up some sort of story to get them off track. Now, saying that it was a flying saucer doesn't make too much sense to me, because that would attract more attention than diverting attention.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
So doing the flying saucer thing was really bizarre. Now, this is my own hypothesis, because I've worked around a lot of top brass people. I've done a lot of briefings with top brass people, and I can see where a top brass person would be frustrated with what's going on. And I can see him turn around and going, I don't care what you say, get it buried, get it done, I don't want to hear this anymore. And so that individual goes around and goes, hey, it was a flying saucer. No problem here. And then the top brass person goes, whoa, wait a second. What are you talking about? It's not a flying saucer. Tell them it's a weather balloon. Okay. And so they go back, and I could see that happening. Now, other people, that have investigated this stuff would say, oh my God, that would never happen. The 508, you know, bomb group, that would never happen. These were the most squared away people we had in the military. They were the only ones that were delivering the atomic bomb. That would not have happened. Well, I've been around a lot of upper echelon military people, and I'm telling you, things like this do happen. But that would make a plausible part of that. The rest of it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense the way that they did the whole cover-up. It doesn't flow well. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
See, if you're going to bury something, why wouldn't you say it's a weather balloon to begin with? Instead of coming out, it's a flying solid. Don't you know everybody is going to want to come look at it?
Yeah.
Why would you say that? That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, mistakes happen.
They do. And, you know, Walter Haught was the public information officer, and he's the one that did the press release. You know, he would not have done a press release without writing it up and handing it to someone, I would say at least, you know, Colonel Blanchard, who was the commander of the Roswell Army Airfield at the time. He would have, I would think, at bare minimum, have seen that before it went out, unless he just, you know, gave it to maybe, some other officer that might have been in charge. Maybe Blanchard didn't want to have anything to do with it, or, you know, he regulated it to his second in command. But, I mean, obviously, once it went out, they immediately recanted that and pulled it back. And, you know, the interesting thing is Walter Haught, you know, he was a young guy at the time. He had been in World War II and stuff, but he was a young guy. And later in life, he actually comes forward and does a couple of affidavits, mm-hmm. some sworn statements that he actually saw part of the aircraft and he saw an alien.
Right.
And one of those affidavits was a sealed affidavit. He said he didn't want open until after he died. So there's, you know, you could throw that in there with the mix. You know, so you're looking at deathbed confessions of guys, and you would think, okay, well, what would the motivation be for doing this at this time? You know, is he trying to clear his conscience, or is he trying to you know, become famous for his kids or his grandkids? You know, what would the motivation be? Or maybe he's sat around all those years and thought about it.
Yeah, and I just some of the comments on his deathbed, you know, like it's they kind of slam it, saying that the document was never written by Haught,
And also, at his age, and he was having some cognitive issues.
Right.
So you could throw all that in there. That's the problem. I worked a murder case one time, and the individuals that committed the murder both got, you know, close to 100 years in jail. And to this day, you know, I was in charge of the case. To this day, I don't know why they did. And the main reason is because they lied to me so much that I don't know what to believe anymore. And that's what happens when you read this case. If you're being objective about this whole investigation, at what point do you go, well, I don't know what's real and what's not, because the government continues to lie to us all throughout this. You know, when Stanton stepped in and you know, really started doing open records requests and really kind of trying to flesh out this stuff, you know, they had Project Sign going, they had Project Grudge going, they had Project Blue Book going, and then, you know, they come out with Project Mogul, and it's like, okay, well, what's what?
Mm.
And of course, we don't want to get off into this, but Then you got the Majestic 12 documents. And then that throws a whole bunch of other conspiracy in there as far as, you know, high-ranking members of this Majestic 12 that know about aliens and, you know, the balloon was a cover story and some other documents that were found in the National Archives that weren't cataloged the way the National Archives would catalog them. And they were found by two guys that were doing UFO research, so that would be really handy to go in the National Archives, bring this stuff with you, and go, look what I found!
Yeah.
You know? And that would be great, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, there's so many red flags of deception in this thing. It's hard to...
Yeah. It'd be really tough to find an actual truth, because one thing leads to another, and it's just confusing. Did you get off on the Area 51 type thing and get into any of the research in that? Or
I've read about Area 51. I've been there, took some pictures there. You know, I was a tourist there.
Right.
Area 51, that's one of those things where that's a top secret military base, and we need to respect that.
Right.
And whatever the heck they're doing over there, keep doing it. Yeah. Because we need to stay on the cutting edge of our defense. And I applaud them for whatever they're doing. You know, there's the theory that, you know, the craft at Roswell possibly went to Area 51. And there's... some guys that have worked over there that said that they saw it. I don't find the little bit that I've read on them very credible. There's a lot of different ideas as far as where the aircraft could have gone to.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about Area 51 other than, like I said, I've been there taking some pictures and went to the little alien. Are you familiar with that?
No, actually, no.
Yeah, it's a little restaurant that's there, and it's called the little alien.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's my experience there, so I can't say that I'm an expert on that, for sure.
Yeah, no. No, it's just when we had Annie Jacobson, you know, the journalist and she wrote that Area 51, you know, the uncensored, and has that memorandum that's from the FBI, and it's claiming of three so-called flying saucers and stuff. And of course, she has simulated her basic theory is that it's it was Germans, that it was recruited from the war.
You know, she is a fantastic reporter.
Yeah.
Her book is a lot bigger than any of my books, so I can't really say.
No.
She's got some major publishers behind her.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's.
There's
a lot of controversy in that book.
Just some of the idea that it could be something like that, and they're dealing with flying saucers and stuff. It's so, so endless. Do you ever think there will be a resolution to this?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. The only thing that they could do at this point is bring some of the material forward. Jesse Marcel, intelligence officer, essentially says he goes to the site, recovers material, brings it back. They put him on an aircraft. They fly him to Carswell Air Force Base. General Ramey has a meeting with him. He says he goes in. He shows General Ramey the material. They look at it. He steps out of the office, goes to another location, comes back. And General Ramey has replaced all that material with the balloon material. And that's where the photographs come from. That was basically Jesse's last last statement of what happened. And so why Jesse Marcel would come forward after a good career in the Air Force and change his story back to the UFO story, I don't see a lot of motivation for that, other than if he wanted to look like a crazy man in a, you know, Roswell movie.
Yeah.
I don't see what he would have gotten out of that. And that's the other interesting thing about this whole deal. If I was a general, let's say, I don't know, Clements McMullen was a deputy head of SAC at the time, the Strategic Air Command. He's over at the Pentagon. Now, everything I've read about McMullen is he was a micromanager. He was into everything. He controlled everything. If something like this happened in Roswell, and they came out with a UFO crash and that's not what it was, and they had to retract it and everything, I would think McMullen would have lost his mind. What in the hell are you people doing out there? I would think that a Colonel William Blanchard, who's in charge of the Roswell Army Airfield, you know, if he orchestrated this ridiculous debacle, instead of just saying right in the front, hey, there's a weather balloon, shut up, everybody go back to work. And you know, and that goes to General Roger Rainey, also command of 8th Air Force, over in Fort Worth. I'm a reasonable guy. I would have for sure replaced William Blanchard and put him on a desk somewhere, and he probably would have never had another promotion. But William Blanchard's career was impeccable. He ended up being one of the Joint Chiefs. He's at the top. He's talking to the president, you know, years after this happens. Hmm. How does a guy who runs this ridiculous debacle, it's a flying saucer. Oh, wait, no, it's a balloon. I got replaced,
yeah.
But they didn't.
No,
they didn't. William Blanchard was the man. He, you know, Joint Chiefs. He's, you don't get much higher than that in the military.
So that's kind of not saying. That's kind of making it look like a cover up.
Oh, it is, absolutely, and there's no doubt. I mean, you know, Colonel DeBose. You can go on to YouTube and just type in Colonel Thomas DeBose, and there's YouTube things. He's sitting right there. He goes, it was a cover story. It was a lie. We were hiding everything. It's a cover story for the Mogul Project, for that. But, you know, who are you going to believe?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense that you would say that it was a flying saucer or a flying disc, depending, you know, yeah, on what they actually told them at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you look at things like that and it just throws, you know, you think about one thing and then you go, yeah, but you look at these complex systems of how all this communication works. And you think, well, that damaged the story here and this supports the story. And then that damages the story and another thing supports it. And it's pretty crazy. And it's like I said, when we started off our conversation, this is one of the best cover-ups and most investigated cover-ups ever in the history of our country.
Yeah. Well, it's just amazing. Just amazing. And the efforts that people go to, like, I was reading about that, taking the original telegram and reanalyzing it and, because
oh, and on the picture with Roger Rainey is sitting there and he's got the paper,
yeah,
in his hand.
Yeah, just, yeah. Like, boy, but that's like, you know, they've really gone to a lot of effort.
Absolutely.
Just
like you said, you know, let's say you got 300 interviews, right?
Yeah.
And you know, the things that you have to consider. When I'm doing case management, I have to look at quality over quantity. You know, does the fact that 300 people say they saw a flying saucer make a flying saucer exist, or does one guy with a wheel of a flying saucer prove that the flying saucer exists? I'll take the wheel. I'm going to take the physical evidence over human malleable memory anytime. And there's a lot of people that will argue about this. I was going to get my degree in psychology until I realized I don't want to hear your problems. And that kind of ruined my whole idea. I thought, well, I could do, you know, maybe industrial psychology or something. Nah, I'm not going to do it. No. I did all the classes except for statistical analysis for behavioral sciences, and I switched. But the main thing is the people that study memory will tell you memories change. You'll have people argue and say, well, wait, how come when I remember 2 plus 2 equals 4, that 10 years later I don't remember 2 plus 2 equals 4? I mean, I do. How come it doesn't change? And that's a little bit different. When you're talking about rote memory, that's a little bit different than experiential memory.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain's kind of fractured up into a lot of different things. People say, well, some people are left brain thinking, some people are right brain thinking. And, you know, if you're creative, you get, you know, this side of your brain working, and if your memory, that's not necessarily true. You know, there's a lot of studies out there that show that, you know, when you're doing art, both sides of your hemispheres are active. And when you're doing math, the same thing. And so your memory is based on little protein bridges, and it builds these little protein bridges as you memorize whatever it is. So if it's rote memory or experiential memory or any of those two mixed, you're still going to have to build these little proteins to remember it. And over time, those proteins will degrade, and that's why you forget a lot of the things that, you know, you've done if you're not exercising those memories, if you're not thinking about them a lot. They'll go away. And then somebody will go, hey, you remember that time we did this? You go, no. And then somebody gives you just a couple of hints. And then you go, oh, yeah. And you kind of build that memory back. Well, that memory will be malleable a little bit. There'll be a little differentiations. And as you get older, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but you go, yeah, you know, I was over there about 10 years ago. And you go, no. That was 25 years ago.
Yeah,
you know, that time compression thing.
Wow.
Starts. My mom's 93 years old, and she goes, oh, you know, a couple of years ago we were there. I was like, no, Mom, that was 1963.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have to look at that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I've noticed it as I get older, how the time just isn't the same. It's just, and how people look and how people things are, you know, you can look at someone and think, oh, yeah, are they at a high school yet? And they're like in college, like you just, your whole perception has changed as you've lived longer. And,
absolutely. And my mom, she told me something one day, and I just looked at her like she was this incredible philosopher. I couldn't believe she brought it up. She goes, yeah, you know, the years get shorter and shorter and shorter. Every year it's just getting, you know, goes by quicker and quicker. I was like, no, it doesn't, Mom. And she goes, yes, it does. I said, no, years are 365 days. And it's just, she goes, no, Greg. When you're 5 years old, going to 6 years old, that is so long. Do you remember how long that was? You couldn't wait till you were 6 years old.
Yeah.
That's because it was 1/6 of your life. It was a huge portion of your life.
Yeah.
When you're 90 years old, that year is 1/90th mm-hmm. of your life.
Yeah.
It's much faster.
Yeah.
She goes, just wait. It's not pleasant.
No. Yeah, I have noticed.
Yeah. So
going crazy.
You know, those are the things that we have to deal with. And you know, and then you have that whole syndrome of you have the incident, then you have the debunking of the incident, you have the submergence of the incident, you have the, you know, mythologizing of the incident, and then it reemerges and everybody's interested in it. All of a sudden, everybody wants to be an expert in it, and, you know, the media gets on it, everybody's on it, And all of a sudden, you know, you have your 500 interviews into this incident. And like you said, maybe 40 of them are actual firsthand knowledge, you know?
Yeah.
So it gets very, very diffused.
Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, as time goes by, there's less and so much less of a chance of us really finding out what happened. And plus, you're right, the media and the movies sort of give people their history, even though they're not accurate.
Absolutely they do. You bet, because, you know, most of the people out there are not studying history.
No.
You know, and if they see, a movie, Noah's Ark, what was that movie that just came out? You go, oh my God.
Yeah.
That was crazy. I didn't realize, you know, like Lord of the Rings meets the Bible.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah. That's just, there's so much to be sold in a movie that, you know,
right.
It's tough.
Yep.
Well, I'll tell you, this has been a interesting conversation. I really love talking to you. It's been good.
I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, just fantastic. Now, if someone has some information or wants to contact you to let you know what really happened, how would they do that?
They could contact me on my website. It's www.authorgreglawson.com. And author as in writing books.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a contact page there. I also have some other pages on places that I might be speaking, and some stories and some other projects that I'm working on. I'm working on some projects here in Central Texas on some Indian sites. That's fairly interesting. So some pioneer sites.
Oh yeah, it probably would be. Yeah, certainly a lot of good history out there to find and to, you know, focus on. I'll tell you,
it was pretty crazy. You know, I pretty much grew up in Austin, and I didn't really think about Austin as being a frontier, you know, a place where, you know, pioneers and Indians killed themselves on a regular basis, killed each other, I should say, on a regular basis. And, I didn't think about, you know, the amount of debauchery that was going on in Austin when it was a young fledgling town, on the frontier, but it was pretty wild down here. And especially being the capital of the state of Texas, you would think that it would be a little bit different, but I think that actually added to the problems. Imagine that.
Yeah. Well, sir, thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you!
This has been a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.